Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. Just for all the times I
welcome to Court Appointed. Two Dudes' Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
I'm kind of feeling really classy sitting here.
Why's that?
Well, I got a tweed sport coat on. I'm sipping on an old fashioned. It's I'm feeling very, very sophisticated.
Well, Professor.
I do have elbow patches on my sport coat.
It's frowned upon.
What are the elbow patches on sport coats for?
I guess they're for so you don't wear a hole in your elbow.
But I mean, I have other sport coats that don't have elbow patches. I've never worn a hole in those.
Specific to those tweed ones for some. Maybe tweed wears out fast or something.
You think?
Something like that. There got to be something to it because that's the kind of coat that has it. I have a gray jacket like that, and it has the elbow pads on it.
Yeah. Elbow pads or patches?
Well, patches.
Okay.
Yeah, not pads. It's not like football.
Yeah, I was like, what do you wear it for?
I've got a sweater that has those too.
Do you?
Yeah. I don't know why, but it's a pullover type sweater. And
was that your Guinness one?
No.
Oh.
No, it's just a regular one. It's good and warm, though.
Your Guinness one has elbow patches too, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so. It's just a long sleeve t-shirt.
Hmm. I don't know. For some reason, I'm picturing Guinness elbow patches for like when you're putting your elbows on the bar drinking your Guinness.
No, but I'll tell you this, though. Here's the thing. They're not really patches. You know, they're decorations. So when they wear out, that means that your sweater has worn out, you know, or your jacket.
I'd say so.
Well, my dad, he doesn't like to throw anything away. So he had a sweater with elbow patches on there. So he comes into the office one day wearing this thing, and I'm said, Dad, you got a hole in your sweater. Yeah, I know, the elbow wore out. And I'm like, well, get a new one. he says, well, I like this one. I'm just trying to find if I can maybe take it to the tailor and see if they can sew some new patches on there.
It's very frugal.
Like, it doesn't work like that. But anyway, he ended up, we had to go online to Amazon and we ordered new elbow patches. And we got them installed on his old sweater.
Seriously?
Yeah, but I'm like, when you wear the elbow patches out, that's like, you know, the stick telling you it's done, you know, or whatever. That's the pop-out thing on the turkey. That's telling you it's done. You throw it out at that point. Right. And it's not like, you know, he's you know, a man of, you know, has to watch every nickel or anything. I mean, you know, he does okay for an old guy.
Yeah.
So
we could probably do a podcast called Dan Smurl Stories.
Oh man. I don't think that would go over too well.
Did we tell the story about the root beer?
I'm sure we told the root beer story.
Yeah. That's my first memory of Dan Smurl.
He used to just come out with these dry wit sayings that would just crack you up. We were talking about going on vacation. And I was saying, well, you know, the Durries, they got this new station wagon with a rack on top, and they've got a carrier, and they put this carrier up on top and put all the suitcases in it, and they got a lot more room. I ain't putting nothing on my roof. It's like, we used to quote that all the time. Anytime he'd say something, I ain't putting nothing on my roof.
I remember he gave Riley that car, and it had a sunroof in it, and he said, well, it's got a sunroof, but I've never opened it. I wouldn't mess with it if I were you.
Yeah, like, that's right.
It's like, what?
That's, you know, I said, oh, you got a sunroof, Dad? Yeah, it's one more thing to break.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of Eeyore.
Eeyore, yeah.
Thanks for noticing. But he always came out something. I remember one day he was sitting there, and he was, we were teenagers, me and my buddy Rodney, and we were there in the kitchen, and he was leaning back on the, we had a bar in there, and he was leaning back on the bar stool, leaning against the back, and he was lecturing us on some wisdom that he was passing on to us poor teenagers. And all of a sudden, the back of the stool just gave out, and he did a backflip out of the back of that thing into the kitchen floor and everything. Rodney fell over. He was laughing so hard. And I started laughing, too. And he gets up, and you can tell he was fighting back, trying to break out laughing, too, as he was looking at us. And he goes, I guess it would really been funny if I broke my neck, huh?
It's good stuff.
I can picture him saying that, too.
Yeah, he was a man of few words, but when he spoke, you listened.
Well, our episode today, we touched about this a little bit on our last episode, but kind of glossed over it a little bit. So I thought it'd be kind of fun and interesting to talk about vetoes.
Vetoes!
So what do you know about vetoes?
They're not related to Cheetos.
They are related to the Godfather.
They're related to the Godfather?
Yeah.
Because he vetoes your ass right into the ground.
His name is Vito Corleone.
Oh, yeah. That's a different kind of veto. This veto has... I believe Latin derivative from the word for forbidden.
Actually, yeah, it means I forbid.
Yeah.
Translated directly. And it is the power which is used by the executive or the officer of a state, generally, although there are some exceptions to that, to unilaterally stop some sort of official action, especially whenever there's going to be some sort of law passed or something along those lines.
I see your law and I veto it.
We touched on it last episode, and we said that there can be absolute veto, which is the instance of the United Nations Security Council, where if there is some sort of legislation and there's a veto, it doesn't matter. It's done. That's all there is to it. It's vetoed. There's also the limited veto, which is similar to what we have here in the United States with regards to the president and most of our states, where if the governor or the president vetoes something, there's a chance for the legislative body with a two-thirds vote to overturn that veto.
Right.
So it's kind of a more of a check and balance. So I don't think that I like the idea of a absolute veto in the power of our executive officer. I think that's probably, I like our system we have with the two-thirds, because if you can get a two-thirds majority of a legislative body to agree on something, that's pretty substantial.
Yeah.
Because especially with partisan politics these days, that's going to be a pretty strong statement to overturn a veto.
I thought it was interesting is that our forefathers, as they were writing the Constitution, actually looked at old Roman law in designing how the veto would work, because your top two people in old Roman law were your consuls, and there were two of them, and they each had the power to veto what the other one did. It was an equal power between the two, so that it kept everything in, like say, the checks and balances. And so they kind of derived their own form of that and put that into play.
I think I read somewhere there was also a chance to kind of keep the aristocracy a bit more in charge as well, because the legislative body might have some sort of more law that's driven more for the people, where the people in power might say, well, you know, I don't think we like that one. So they'd veto that.
Yeah.
So that's also can be one way to kind of view it.
Well, you're always going to have, with whenever you have a two-party or more system, a multi-party system, you're going to have differences of opinion. And so that's the only way to keep everything in check. You can't give one person the power completely. So
differences of opinion, is that what you would consider what we have right now in the United States?
Oh, God. No, it's much, much worse than that. Much worse.
There's a slight difference of opinion going on right now.
There's the one lady that's running for Senate against Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, and we see her commercials over here.
Yeah.
And she's talking about how the country is so divided that you can't even discuss a leader without having a fight in your own family or something to that effect. You know,
I can agree to that.
That everything's so bad. So I saw somebody had a meme out that had something about if you want to cut down on your Christmas list, just bring up politics at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, there you go. That'll work.
You can scratch a few people off after that.
So whenever I was getting ready to do this episode, I kept thinking about vetoes, and I kept thinking about something you had told me a long time ago about your fraternity days.
Yeah.
So you remember, you're a SIGEP,
mm-hmm.
and I actually ended up being an ATO. But I remember you all had some sort of system when somebody was going to pledge a fraternity that if you didn't like them, you could essentially veto them by throwing a black ball against them.
The pledges, yeah. Yeah, and everybody had a black ball, and if there was a pledge that was presented and you didn't think that pledge, when it came time to make the decision, if you didn't think that they should be a part of your fraternity, then you could put out a black ball.
Now, is a single black ball enough to keep somebody out, or does it have to be more majority?
Well, it didn't have to be a majority. There was a discussion. I mean, mm-hmm. basically you did it, and then you kind of, it was basically a vote after that.
So it wasn't secretive then?
No, it wasn't secretive because it had to be discussed.
Yeah.
Now, there was also, along those same lines, that say that you had somebody that was already a member of your fraternity, but they were just doing things that you thought was bringing shame to your fraternity, or they weren't a good fraternity brother or whatever else.
Right.
I'd always understood that you could take a 2/3 vote on them, and you could bring that up at your active meetings is, you know, I nominate so-and-so for a 2/3 vote, and here's why. Ooh. I think.
That would probably not be fun.
You got to really be pissed at somebody to do that.
I'd yeah. say so.
So I did do that once. There was a guy that I didn't like that was in there.
Oh, really?
And I did bring that up, and we had a rather robust discussion about, a lot of people agreed, yeah, he does do these kind of things, and he does need to watch that, but we don't want to vote him out.
Was he there?
Yeah, he was there because he was one of the actives.
Well, how did he feel about this?
Oh, he was waiting to meet me outside when we finished.
Did he change his ways?
No, not really. The closest I could compare him to is if you've ever seen Animal House.
Yeah.
He was just like John Belushi's character.
Yeah.
Only in a bad way.
Yeah.
So.
The fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son.
Yeah. I won't name him. He's no longer with us. So there's no reason for me to cast disparaging things on him.
And God threw a black ball against him.
Yeah, that's right. God blackballed him, so I didn't have to.
If God blackballs you, you don't need a 2/3.
See, that's what he gets for going up against me. I may not have won the 2/3, but I'm still here.
Easy. But yeah, that the black ball is kind of a veto thing that is you see a lot in different kinds of clubs, Masonic lodges, and fraternities. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we didn't have that in ours. I think probably if it had come down to it and somebody did something pretty egregious, then we probably would have had to invoke whatever rule there was to do that. I'm sure there was one to do that. But
well, did you just take every pledge that pledged?
No. We gave out invitations. You had to get an invitation to be a pledge.
Well, yeah, but you're giving people an invitation, and you may have just met them once or twice at a rush party or something.
Yeah.
So once you get them there as a pledge, isn't there ones where you say, you know what, this guy ain't going to make it. This guy isn't what we thought he was cracked up to be.
Well, we were pretty.
Did you cut him, or you just took anybody that came along? You guys were like, you know, hey, you're homeless? Come on, join our fraternity.
No, we were very discriminating about who we offered a pledgeship to. So okay. We would offer a pledgeship to somebody. There was one or two that kind of, once they came around a little bit, we were kind of like, oh, that guy's really not somebody we want to have around. So, and then sometimes they didn't make grades, then it kind of took care of itself. So
the fraternities are having all their own problems right now with all the hazing incidents and people dying. We never had people dying that I know of when it did, and there was a whole lot more hazing went on when I was involved in fraternities.
See, and that was back in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
See, in the 90s, we did not have any kind of hazing. And I don't know that was kind of abnormal, or we were just our fraternities didn't have it, but Our whole concept was, like, if you want somebody to be like your fraternity brother, why do you want to beat on them? It doesn't make much sense.
Well, they did we did horrible stuff to each other back in that days, including being set on fire. So, I mean,
whoa. Yeah. Sounds like we needed a podcast called Tommy's Fraternity Stories, too.
I'm just glad I wasn't very hairy in those days.
maybe you used to be.
Yeah, that might be why I have a smooth chest now.
So, getting back to the actual
vetoes,
the institution of a veto was known to the Romans as intercessio, And as you said, it was adopted by the Roman Republic around the 6th century BC to enable the tribunes to protect the interests of the plebeians from the encroachments of the patricians who dominated the Senate. So when I said that it was the way to keep the lower class down, I think I had that backwards, actually. But a tribune's veto did not prevent the Senate from passing a bill, but it meant that it was denied from the force of law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our U.S. system, the way it works, and I think we talked about this a little bit last episode, but we'll kind of go over it, is that proposed legislation or bills that is passed by both Congress and the Senate goes to the president, and that's called presentment. And the president, or the governor, if we're talking about states, in their capacity as the head of the executive branch, has the option to either sign the bill, which would make it go into law,
right,
or veto it and send it back to the legislative body. Now, there's a little bit of a difference here. And for the most part, in the United States, we have what's called a bicameral system. And by bicameral, I mean that there's going to be a House and a Senate. There's going to be two different legislative bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So before it can get to the president or the governor, it has to pass both those different legislative bodies.
Right.
There is one state that has a unicameral government.
And a unicamel? Is that a camel with one hump?
No, they only have the Senate, and that is Nebraska. And as of 1937, they only have one legislative body. So they don't have a House and a Senate. They just have just a Senate.
Well, they couldn't afford the House?
They just thought it might be more efficient that way. I don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but I thought that was pretty interesting that they only have one legislative body, because I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I didn't think you were allowed to operate that way.
I don't. My Nebraska state history is not up to speed.
Well, we'll have to check on them corn huskers.
That's right. So, as I said, if the president or the governor approves the bill, they sign it into law. And according to Article 1, Section 7 of the U.S. Constitution, if the president does not approve the bill and chooses not to sign it, he can return it unsigned within 10 days, excluding Sundays, to the House of the United States Congress, in which it originated, while Congress is in session. So the president has basically 10 days. The president is constitutionally required to state any objections to the bill in the writing, and the Congress is required to consider them and reconsider the legislation. Once returned the unsigned bill to Congress, then that's considered a veto, and then they have a chance to vote on it again. And if Congress overrides the veto by 2/3 vote in each House, then it becomes law without the president's signature. So the president doesn't even have to sign it. If they fail to get the 2/3 vote, then the bill fails to become law unless it is presented to the president again and the president decides to sign it this time. But if the president already said once they're not going to sign it, chances are they're not going to sign it the second time.
Yeah.
Congress has overridden the presidential veto 7% of the time. So 7% of the time the president's vetoed it, they've gotten that 2/3 vote. So that goes to show you how hard it is to get a 2/3 majority.
And there have been 2,572 vetoes.
2,572?
Mm-hmm.
That's more than one a year.
That's a lot of vetoes.
It is a lot of vetoes.
Yeah. There's also a pocket veto.
There is, yeah.
Which means that the governor or the president doesn't sign the bill after the Congress has adjourned. And then that becomes a pocket veto. So,
yeah, now there is a chance where if Congress has adjourned before that, they can come back in session just to consider that during that time and extend it. So there's kind of some ways around that.
Well, and sometimes for whatever reason, political reasons or whatever, a governor or president doesn't want to put his name on a bill, so he won't sign it.
Yeah.
So it returns and then it gets that 2/3 vote and passes. And what he's saying in a lot of cases, if he doesn't really come out against it, you know, that's okay. I understand you all want to pass this. You can go ahead. I just don't want to be a part of it.
Right.
And so that's kind of a political maneuver.
Fundamentally, I disagree with this, but
right.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, because usually if they're vetoing something, they don't want it to be law. And so they're trying to, you know, shoot it down. But they can just not sign it and let it be passed into law, and it quietly does it without them being attached.
In my capacity as a lawyer, I've sometimes had to watch legislation after it's passed both the House and the Senate. It's been presented to the governor, and trying to watch it and see, okay, is the governor going to sign this? Mm-hmm. Because it's not law till the governor signs it.
That's right.
And you're sitting there watching it. And our website for our state, they don't necessarily update it real time, especially the legislative tracking history and things like that. So I'm like, well, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. It's getting close. And we have clients that it might affect the legislation might affect their business and things like that. They're like, what's going on? What's going on with Bill 372? I don't know. Everybody is getting stressed out. And then finally the governor puts their John Hancock on it and you're like, okay, rest easy.
Yeah, but then usually it's a year before it takes effect or well, 6 months or something.
Each bill has a different kind of enactment in it about when it right. becomes law. Mm-hmm. A lot of them
say, it depends on what needs to be done before it can take place, because sometimes there's things that have to be done before a law can take place.
Well, that's true, but a lot of times they're modifications of existing laws. Mm-hmm. So they say that comes into effect 60 days after it's enrolled.
Right.
And when something's enrolled, that basically means when it becomes enrolled in the books and it's law.
Boy, there's some interesting legislation in Congress right now that's being watched.
Oh, about the marijuana?
Yeah.
I saw that. Well, I guess it's gone through some sort of committee about it's changing its schedule from Schedule 1 to something else or another.
Yeah, to make it legal, basically, where the federal government would legalize it.
Well, now, they would recognize that it has some sort of legitimate medical interest, I think.
Well, right? Not just for medical. They're decriminalizing it.
Right.
And so they think they got the votes in the House to pass it. So the Senate, they're not so sure about.
I think there was also some sort of expungement in it where it would actually expunge the record of people that have certain marijuana
convictions. Exactly. You would be released from prison if you were in there on a marijuana charge, and it would expunge your record as long as that's all you were in there for.
Yeah.
Then that's what they would do.
I think that's probably, I mean, I haven't read the bill as they've proposed it. I don't think it's made it out of committee just yet, but in theory, I don't have a problem with that. And I think it'd be a good step in the right direction.
It said like 77% of the United States is in favor of legalizing marijuana.
Look at me. I'm in the majority. How about that?
There you go.
Maybe I'm not so conservative after all.
But it'll be interesting to see how that progresses, because you've got, like our state, we passed a medical marijuana law 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And we still don't have any medical marijuana being sold because we can't figure out how to institute the law.
Well, and the bad thing is, I think the way the law is going to be put into effect is that it's going to require such a financial commitment to even get into the business of it that it's going to be pushed over to large pharmaceutical type
right.
industries, mm-hmm. which I think that might defeat the purpose of why you're doing it, but I don't know.
Yeah, it needs to grow like home brewing did. You know, craft breweries and stuff like that. Look at what that's doing for local economies all over the United States.
If every person was entitled to grow like 2 or 3 plants, I think it would probably work itself out.
Well, no, I'm not even saying that. I'm talking about like craft breweries where they're small local breweries that are able to grow and, I mean, able to do that.
Yeah.
And what if you did that with, you know, in the state, we're only going to sell homegrown stuff and put people to work doing that. You know? West Virginia gold, blue and gold.
West Virginia blue and gold?
Yeah.
No, we're more about the green.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, the money.
No, Marshall, what are you talking about?
The money's all green.
Now, if the president or the governor, they do send back the veto with some sort of message as to why they're vetoing it, those statements don't really have any kind of value to them other than giving their reasoning as to why they are not signing it. It's not like it requires them to do anything different. It's just kind of like,
right.
That's just their 2 cents on it.
Yeah. Well, it could be in some cases, maybe if they reintroduce the bill with an amendment or something, maybe the governor or president says, if it did this or that, or added this or took into account that, then maybe they have the decision then, do we want to add this in and then we can get it passed? Or is he just doing that again for posturing? He's letting them know why he's fighting this battle. He doesn't like it for this reason. Now, if you're going to override it, then you're the ones taking responsibility for it. I came out and said no.
And sometimes they grandstand when they do this, when they have a signing, and they'll have the bill with cameras rolling, like, okay, and we're going to sign this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, nope, actually, I'm going to veto it, and here's why. And then they'll send it back. If they want to try to raise their...
And that's someone who's worried about the 2/3 majority in a lot of cases. They're afraid they are going to override him. And so he's getting that out to the public and trying to get public consensus on his side.
They're trying to lobby.
Yeah. So that he can not look bad.
Now, have you ever heard of a legislative veto?
No, I have. Can't say that I have.
Well, a legislative veto refers to the power of a legislature or one of the houses of a different legislature to nullify the action of an executive authority.
Mm-hmm.
So this practice actually was common in the U.S. at the federal level until the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional in 1983 in the INS v. Chadha case.
Chadha.
Chadha. C-H-A-D-H-A. It's a...
Is that an acronym?
No, it's the gentleman's name.
Oh.
Yeah, it's an Indian name. Jagdish Rai Chadha. Oh, I think that's how you pronounce it. I don't know. I'm not very good with
pronouncing. Well, we need our linguists. We had somebody volunteer on Facebook to pronounce all the English names that we've been butchering. Well mostly me have been butchering.
This isn't an English name, though.
Well, that's true.
So there was an INS Act, and it authorized the INS to suspend deportation of an alien continually residing in the U.S. for at least 7 years, where the U.S. Attorney General, in their discretion, found that the deportation would result in extreme hardship. After they made such a finding, the Attorney General would transmit the report to Congress, and either House of Congress had the power to veto the Attorney General's determination. So the INS, they get their authority from the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
So the naturalization, immigration, things like that, that's traditionally an executive branch function. So the executive branch has delegated that to the INS. They're the ones who are in charge of that. So they are essentially the executive branch. So the way this process worked is that if somebody was going to be deported, they could find an extreme hardship, and then it would go to either the Senate or the House to vote on it, or actually both of them. And if they could actually veto it because they said, no, we don't think that's an extreme hardship, and that would override, that'd be a legislature overriding the executive branch by a veto.
Hmm.
So that's called a legislative veto. But what happened in this case was that Mr. Chadha was born in Kenya to Indian parents. He was a citizen of the UK and entered the US under a British passport while studying in Ohio as a foreign exchange student. Kenya declared independence from Britain in 1963, so he was not recognized as a legitimate citizen or resident of Kenya, since his parents were Indian, or India, since he was born in Kenya, and his right of abode in the United Kingdom was stripped under the Immigration Act of 1971 due to his lack of connection with the UK. So this was essentially a man
without a country.
A man without a country. And his non-immigrant student visa expired in 1972, so he really had nowhere to go. So the INS initiated deportation proceedings against him.
They didn't know where to deport him,
which they probably should have done.
Yeah.
He sought to suspend it and basically cited this extreme hardship, like, I don't have anywhere to go.
Yeah,
like,
you can't deport somebody to somewhere they don't belong.
So basically, the case went through, they found the extreme hardship, they sent it over to Congress, and the House of Representatives vetoed the suspension of his deportation, basically saying, no, we don't see an extreme hardship, go ahead and deport him. I don't know where to, but
the middle of the ocean, halfway in between here and the UK.
Yeah. So he appealed, and the Board of Immigration Appeals found that it lacked any authority to consider constitutional objections to it. Then it was appealed to the Ninth Circuit for review of deportation. The INS actually supported his challenge to the constitutionality of it. So INS was kind of sided with Chadha, which is interesting. And the Ninth Circuit found that basically this was unconstitutional, basically have this the legislature having the ability to veto the executive branch. And they ordered the Attorney General to suspend the deportation proceedings. So the Ninth Circuit decision was appealed to the Supreme Court to get a final determination about whether or not this legislative veto was constitutional or not. The House and the Senate argued that the Ninth Circuit erred by holding the resolution of the House of Representatives vetoing the Attorney General's determination was invalid, and it asked the Supreme Court to reverse the Ninth Circuit decision. So basically, the House and the Senate, they're trying to keep their legislative veto power, and they're saying, no, we should be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Congress, their argument was basically that Chadha lacks standing to challenge the constitutionality because that section is not severable, and if he were to succeed in validating it, his means of remedy would also be destroyed. So it's kind of a very creative thing. So basically, if that whole law was invalid,
mm-hmm.
then basically his whole way of challenging it would be destroyed too, which is kind of interesting.
Well, that's true. Well, the other thing is, if he's not a citizen, how can he doesn't have the same rights if he's not a citizen?
Well, no, he still has due process rights. Mm. You still have due process regardless if you're a citizen or not.
Oh. Well, that's true.
The court did not have jurisdiction over the issue because the Attorney General and INS enforced the challenge statute and thereby effectively waived their right to challenge it. and the action was not a genuine case or controversy, as both the original plaintiff and defendant challenged the statute without real opposition, and also that it was a political question. So they had all these different arguments as to why that the Supreme Court shouldn't hear it. And, you know, looking at the whole case or controversy thing, I kind of understand that's a pretty strong argument right there, because both Chadha and the INS were both on the same side.
Yeah.
Not really a case or controversy there.
Well, but didn't the INS have to bring the action in the first place?
Well, they did. But then basically they challenged it themselves, essentially saying that, you know, we don't agree with this.
Why couldn't they have just quietly dropped it and walked away?
Well, you have to think this was coming from the executive branch.
Yeah.
So the INS, whoever the director is appointed by the president and all that. So this was probably a bit of a power play by the executive branch saying, we don't like the legislature being able to veto something we're doing.
Mm.
So I think it had more ramifications than just this case.
It was one of those principled matters.
Yeah, exactly. And Chief Justice Burger.
Is that Burger King?
Nope. Just Burger.
I knew a Ron Burger.
I know hamburger. I like cheeseburger better. The court held that the resolution of the House of Representatives vetoing the Attorney General's determination was constitutionally invalid, unenforceable, and not binding. Congress may not promulgate a statute granting to itself a legislative veto over actions of the executive branch inconsistent with bicameralism principles in the presentment clause of the U.S. Constitution. So what they said is that, well, Congress enacted this law and gave themselves the power to veto it. So they essentially gave themselves the power over top of the executive branch, which...
Well, that's kind of double-dipping.
It is. So I mentioned the presentment clause, and I just want to touch on that real quick. So the presentment clause is part of the U.S. Constitution, and it outlines the legislative procedure about how bills become law. And this is basically what we're talking about, how the bill passes two different, the House and the Senate, and then goes to the president for the signing or the veto and all that. That's essentially what the presentment clause is, that has to be presented to the president or the governor for the finalization of it. So That's what the presentment clause is.
So, okay.
Now there's one more famous veto case. I know you can't believe it. There's this many famous veto cases out there.
Well, yeah. In my research, I came across several of them.
Did you now?
Yeah.
This one was Clinton v. City of New York. Did you come across that one?
No. Oh. No, mine had to do with the president, presidential vetoes, not, you know, cities or states or things like that.
Okay. Well, this one's a presidential veto.
Oh, okay.
This one's kind of interesting.
Well, I didn't hear a president's name in there.
Clinton?
Oh, Clinton. I thought you said Quinn.
No, Clinton.
Oh, Clinton.
You didn't hear a president's name in there, huh?
No. Now I did. That's Hillary's name.
Yeah, exactly. Her husband had some sort of executive office, too, I think, at some point.
Did he?
Yeah, I can't remember which one. So this was a 1998 case, and Justice John Paul Stevens, which is one of my favorite names for a justice.
He was in Led Zeppelin, wasn't he?
Maybe so. There was a law that allowed the president to unilaterally amend or repeal parts of statutes by using line item cancellations.
Yeah.
And essentially what that means is that if there was just a certain line or something in one of these bills, the president could just strike that line out.
And then pass the rest of it.
Pass the rest of it.
Yeah.
And
line item veto.
Exactly. And in this
I've heard of that.
Clinton v. City of New York case, they held that it violated the presentment clause that I just said, because The presentment clause is very clear about the way this procedure works.
They present the bill, and he's got to accept all the bill or veto all the bill. He can't pick and choose what he likes.
You strictly construe it as it is written, because that's how you have to look at these things.
Well, otherwise, you're misconstruing it.
Well, there's whole theories about if you're a strict constructionist. If you're a strict constructionist, you think that basically everything in the Constitution should be read at face value, exactly what it means.
Right.
If you're looking in the penumbras or the lines in between the lines,
then you're trying to interpret what they meant.
So yeah. You're not essentially a strict constructionist.
Right.
I think there's a bit of a... You have to be a little bit of both. You can't be one or the other. Like anything, there's a gray area.
I don't think you can stretch it too far. I think that you do need to stick to it, and I think that there's a lot of examples where that's taken place.
So the Supreme Court said that the silence of the Constitution on the subject of a unilateral president action is essentially the same thing as an express prohibition. Not in there. They're not agreeing to it.
Yeah. You can't say, well, it doesn't say that specifically, but it doesn't say you can't.
Precisely. The quote was, "In accord with a single, finely wrought, and exhaustively considered procedure," is how they describe the presentment clause. Finely wrought.
Finely wrought. No, that's not R-O-T, though.
No.
That's W-R-O-U-G-H-T.
Correct. Like, yeah. You know, finely crafted.
Yeah.
So essentially, the bill had to be approved or rejected by the president in its entirety.
I think that makes sense.
It does. So here's the interesting thing. Even though that was struck down in 1998, President George W. Bush asked Congress to enact legislation that would return the line item veto power to the executive.
Yeah.
So George W. Bush announced his intent to seek this legislation on January 31st, 2006, during the State of the Union address, and sent a legislative proposal to Congress on March 6, 2006, using its prompt passage, which is a kind of a procedure where the president's already drafted it and it goes straight to a vote.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Bill Frist, Senator John McCain, and Republican Whip Mitch McConnell, who we just talked about, jointly introduced this proposal. That same day, Joshua Bolton, the director of Office Management and Budget, gave a press conference on the president's line item veto proposal. Bolton explained that the proposed act would give the president the ability to single out wasteful spending and to put such spending on hold. While the spending line item is on hold, the president can send legislation to Congress to rescind the particular line item. The proposal would then be considered in both houses within 10 days on an up or down basis and could be passed by a simple majority. And additionally, such proposals could not be filibustered. So what they were trying to say is they were trying to change it just enough to maybe squeak by.
Yeah.
What the...
So saying, all right, so he strikes out this one thing, but he signs it. So the rest of the bill passes, and that one thing then is returned to Congress.
Correct.
For them to vote on, but instead of a two-thirds, they only need a simple majority.
Right.
To put that line back in if he struck it out.
Exactly. And it would almost be like kind of putting that line item on hold, just to make sure.
Yeah.
But I think there's room for abuse with that, with partisan politics.
Right.
That's just my take on it.
Yeah.
When asked how it was different, Bolton had said that whereas the former act granted unilateral authority to the executive to disallow the line items, the new proposal would seek congressional approval of such line item vetoes. So
they wouldn't have voted for it to be in there in the first place if they didn't want it in there.
Exactly. And even though it was a little bit weaker than the 1996 version, it actually failed to find any support in Congress. And one Senator Robert C. Byrd of West Virginia called it an offensive slap at Congress.
Well, you know why he called it that.
Why is that?
Because he was the pork barrel king.
He was.
He brought more federal dollars to West Virginia than anybody that there was. We were receiving more federal dollars per capita than any other state in the nation.
God bless his soul.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we have all these bridges and buildings and roads named after him. Because he brought in so much, and he didn't want anybody to mess with that. And it sounds like that's exactly what that was aimed towards.
It could have been. And
he was over the Appropriations Committee. That's why he got so much.
That the legislation would enable the president to intimidate individual members of Congress by targeting the projects of their political opponents. And basically said the line item veto, as proposed, would take away Congress's constitutional power of the purse and give it to the executive branch. So what that would do is split the separation of powers by doing that. So,
well, I think that, like, in a lot of this research I did on some of these vetoes and the ones that they pointed out were good ones, they all had to do with that the bill they felt that was trying to be passed was in some way changing the Constitution or reinterpreting the Constitution. And so that's why they were vetoed. And they also, in a lot of them, they were things that could lead to later corruption. It's like, yes, that would be okay, but they were like individual things for stuff. And so you can't do that. The federal government isn't here to subsidize individual projects of people that want to get something going, you know?
Now, here's the interesting thing is that states actually do have line item vetoes. It's just the federal government does not. So in different states, there are actually line item vetoes allowed by the governor. So
that's probably more where I've heard that from is line item vetoes is has to do with state government. Because I've heard the discussion on that before. I've never really paid that much attention to what it meant.
So 44 of the 50 U.S. states give the governors the power to have some sort of form of line item veto with regards to legislation. Indiana, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Rhode Island, Vermont are the exceptions. And the mayor of Washington, D.C. has the power, too. So if you're talking about D.C., the mayor can do that because they're the executive branch. Mm-hmm. So most of the states actually do have some sort of line item veto. One interesting thing I was reading is that the Confederate States Constitution actually had line item veto in it.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, it was different than the U.S. Constitution. They wanted to change that. Which is kind of interesting if you think about it, because traditionally, when you think about the argument for Confederate states and things like that, they try to frame it more as a states' rights issue, mm-hmm. where they want a less powerful central government. But by actually giving the line item veto, you're actually making a stronger central government. So it's kind of a backwards principle for what you're saying you have there. Anyway.
Well, I did some research on some of the best vetoes in American history. That's right.
Well, I hope Vito Corleone's on that, because he is definitely one of the best vetoes.
He is not on there. He was not a good veto. He's a murdering veto.
Drop the line item. Grab the cannoli.
President James Garfield named his dog Vito.
I thought you were going to say Otis.
No, Vito. He wanted to send a message. However, he never did veto anything because he was only in office 5 months because he died.
He was a very unhealthy man, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So
he ate too much lasagna, I think, was the problem.
All right. The number 10 one that they said was George Washington. Now, George Washington only issued 2 vetoes in the 8 years he was in office. But this one had a large effect. Said the Constitution provided that Congress shall apportion seats in the House of Representatives according to population. The initial bill that reached Washington's desk called for 1 representative for every 30,000 persons in each state, but with a special allowance. The 8 states with the largest fraction of persons after dividing the populations by 30,000 were given an extra member of Congress. This naturally favored the larger states at the time and would tend to inflate the influence of the Federalists over their smaller governmental rivals. Secretary of State and future President Thomas Jefferson advised Washington to kill the bill and demand that Congress apportion without gimmicks and favoritism. Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, ever heard of him?
Alexander Hamilton.
He was more interested in growing federal power and urged that the bill be made law. Washington wisely sided with Jefferson. A replacement bill that the president signed in the same year apportioned seats in Congress according to 1 for every 33,000 instead of 30,000, a more accurate ratio that avoided the fractional chicanery. Washington's 2 successors, John Adams 1 term and Thomas Jefferson 2 terms, never vetoed anything.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. So if you think about the 2,572 vetoes, I think that was the number you'd said, that took place, that's probably...
There's only 2 in the first 3 presidents.
Quite a few in the past few years.
Now, Franklin Roosevelt. FDR holds the record for the most vetoes by any president, a total of 635.
Wow.
Of course, he held the office for slightly more than 3 terms.
He did. He was an exception.
And the record for a president that served 2 full terms? Grover Cleveland. He nixed 584 bills, more vetoes than those of all the previous 21 presidents combined.
Huh.
And unlike Cleveland's, a good number of Roosevelt's vetoes were of bills he should have signed. Nonetheless, like the proverbial broken clock that's right twice a day, FDR did a good deed from time to time. One was the day he killed a lavish veterans pension proposal called the Bonus Bill. 1935, a vote-buying scheme by his own party, it would have massively and gratuitously increased federal payments to World War I soldiers and their dependents. So think about it. You're on the party and you're saying everybody that's a veteran from World War I, which would be a large number of people that it would affect, we're going to give you this bonus of all this money added to your pension. All you got to do is keep us in office.
Yeah.
So that
sounds a little shady.
Yeah. So in his veto message, FDR offered multiple justifications for his action. Congress had already provided considerable benefits to veterans. Just over the next 10 years, under the then current law, he explained, Washington would be paying veterans $13.5 billion, a sum equal to more than 3/4 of the entire cost of our participation in the war. And 10 years from now, most of the veterans of that war will be barely past the half past the half century mark or 50 years old.
Right.
So they're still going to be drawing on that for a while. So
here you go, Boomer.
Some in Congress supported the bill on grounds that the additional spending would stimulate the economy as if it was manna from heaven. But FDR responded, "Wealth is not created, nor is it more equitably distributed by this method. A government, like an individual, must ultimately meet legitimate obligations out of the production of wealth by the labor of human beings applied to the resources of nature. Every country that has attempted the form of meeting its obligation, which is here provided, has suffered disastrous consequences."
I had a very similar situation, not similar, but something kind of relatable to that earlier today. I sit on the board for a local kind of charity type thing, mm-hmm. and there's just simply not enough money to do all the work that you want to do.
Right.
And unfortunately, you kind of have to pick and choose and kind of cut some corners about some things, even though you don't want to do it because you really want to help people.
But right.
It's tough decisions.
Yeah.
So you have to live within your means, essentially. And I think that was basically what FDR did there.
The government
It's not that he didn't probably think that those veterans deserved that, mm-hmm. but just that, hey, we can't do this.
Well, also, if at the heart of it was people just trying to get reelected.
That's true, too.
Then, yeah, it was the right thing to do.
I mean, I'm basing it on the altruistic efforts for our veterans, but I'm sure that some people are just kind of pandering to them.
Number 8 was Andrew Johnson on removal of appointees. Sober or not, Andrew Johnson wasn't much to write home about. However, his veto of the Tenure of Office Act in 1867, which Congress overrode, was entirely justified and eventually completely vindicated. A much maligned president who didn't deserve half the mud thrown at him, he deserves praise on this matter. When Republican Abraham Lincoln, this was odd, Republican Abraham Lincoln chose him, who was a pro-Union Democrat, mm-hmm. To be his vice president, on his ticket in 1864, he was hoping the choice would win him re-election and help build consensus for a smooth restoration of the Union after the war. He achieved the first objective, but not the second. An assassin's bullet put Johnson in the White House in 1865, and his subsequent relations with a hostile Congress were anything but smooth. To thwart Johnson, hardliners pushing a tough stance against the post-Civil War South passed the Tenure of Office Act. It basically said, all the cabinet members and everybody that Abraham Lincoln had put into place, you got to keep them. You can't pick your own people. You can't put in any other cabinet members. You got to keep the ones that are there.
Yeah.
Well, that's not really, they interpreted that, but it was kind of like what you said, that it doesn't say you can't do that, but it doesn't say you can. So they tried to pass a law that basically amended the Constitution that said you have to keep the people once they're in, even though it says it does say the president shall choose the people that serve on his cabinet. It doesn't say you can't remove them, but it had always been the practice. The new president coming in didn't have to keep the people that were there.
Yeah.
They choose their own.
Yeah.
So that's why he vetoed it, because he wasn't going to go.
Well, and again, that's a power play between the executive and legislative branch.
Right. And they didn't like him. And of course, he came within one vote. He was impeached. He came within one vote of being voted out of office.
Yeah.
But he wasn't. And so even though they did override the veto, that was in 1866. They turned around and repealed it in 1887. They tried again in the 1920s to pass it again, and it was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court.
As well, I think it is.
Calvin Coolidge came in at number 7 and farm subsidies. Let's see, he was involved with the rejection of the McNary-Hogan Farm Relief Act as among the best of a good president's 50 vetoes. He vetoed 50 times.
McNary-Hogan Farm Relief Act.
Yep. And it says Coolidge, in fact, killed it twice. It said the McNary-Hogan
bill. Send it up here. I'll send it back again.
That's right. The McNary-Hogan bill would have injected the federal government massively into agriculture. Coolidge staved that off for a while, but we eventually got an even worse version less than a decade later in the form of Franklin Roosevelt's ridiculous and unconstitutional Agricultural Adjustment Act. Folsom argues that McNary-Hogan would have fixed prices of some crops by a complicated bureaucratic system and passed the costs on to American consumers. Even if it had helped farmers, it would have hurt everybody else. Coolidge declared that such action would establish bureaucracy on such a scale as to dominate not only the economic life, but the moral, social, and political future of our people. Hmm. So
we're,
it wasn't just helping the farmer. It was basically injecting the U.S. government into running farms.
Yeah, what was it the Ronald Reagan said? The worst thing you can hear, I'm from the government, I'm here to help.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a little scary.
Ulysses Grant had 93 vetoes. Little in his background would suggest he was a financial genius, but he was right on the money issue. In the latter half of the 19th century, the idea took hold in certain quarters that inflating the money supply was good economics. So they tried to pass a bill to inflate the money supply, and he stood firm with his advisors that sticking to the gold standard, and all money had to be backed by the gold standard, and we avoided having a terrible inflation that probably would have brought about like a crash like they had in the 20s, a depression. James Madison had to pass a veto on, he used seven times he vetoed over the course of an eight-year presidency, and it had to do with separation of church and state. And there were several different ones. The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment is unambiguous. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So in February 1811, apparently reading the words, except every now and then, into the text, Congress passed an act incorporating the Protestant Episcopal Church in the town of Alexandria in the District of Columbia. Madison deep-sixed it as a breach of the Establishment Clause. Then he also did the same thing in Mississippi Territory when they were granted public lands to a Baptist church. Huh. So let's see. Let's skip down to the number one veto. Grover Cleveland and the Texas Seed Bill. Now, this has to do with what I was talking about, Robert C. Byrd. Mm-hmm. Same type thing. The same president who holds the record for the most vetoes in two terms earns a prize for the single best as well. For a lot of reasons, as I've written here.
Well, if you veto everything, you're probably going to get one that's going to be the best veto.
That's right. He wanted to increase his odds. All right. When the drought struck Texas in the mid-1880s, a majority in Congress thought it was a federal government's business. So off to President Cleveland's desk went the Texas Seed Bill to grab $10,000 from the rest of the country for aiding farmers in the Lone Star State. That was equivalent of at least $2 million in today's money. Now, in 2018, the only debate over such a bill would be its stinginess. Not even a $20 trillion national debt would prompt most congressmen to think about the affordability of it, let alone its wisdom on any other ground. Cleveland took a principled stand, and he said, "I can find no warrant for such an appropriation in the Constitution. And I do not believe that the power and duty of the general government ought to be to extend to the relief of individuals suffering, of individual suffering, which is in no manner properly related to the public service or benefit. A prevalent tendency to disregard the limited mission of this power and duty should, I think, be steadfastly resisted to the end that the lesson should be constantly enforced that though the people support the government should not support the people."
Wow. I'm going to stand up and clap for that. I mean, he really put some thought into that whole message.
Yeah, like, that's right.
Very so, principled.
Yeah.
Well, you got to be careful about which ones are good and bad. I guess ones that were vetoed a long time ago, you can kind of project what the effect of that might have been. But you have the power of looking back with hindsight to determine that, hey, that wasn't a good idea. But if a president vetoes something today, it's hard to say if it's good or bad because you really don't know what the effect of it's going to be. I mean, you can make your educated guess, and based upon your political... I almost think that in this day and age that our government is so partisan politics, it's just... I don't even really...
Well, that's the problem. Are they getting vetoed just simply because they came from the other side?
I think a lot of times stuff is happening like that in this day and age.
But you can't get anything passed right now. You got a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, so you're not getting anything passed anyway unless everybody already agrees on it.
Well, you know? Fortunately, you know, our government is really not in a bad place where it is where with laws on the books, I think. So stalemate, I'm fine with it.
Well, and what I noticed out of those two that they picked, most all those were situations where the veto had to do with defending the Constitution.
Yeah.
Instead of people adding in things for personal gain here or there, because, you know, the seed bill you give them for because they had a drought. Mm-hmm. All right. Now you go give this guy says, well, we had something over here. We want something. And so then you set up a situation where all these people are trying to get their own slice of pie.
You know what that sounds like?
What?
FEMA.
Yeah. It does sound like FEMA.
I think we have it. It's just called something different now.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to
legal briefs.
You know how it's time for legal briefs?
You know what? Do what?
Do you know how I know it's time for legal briefs?
How do you know?
My drink is almost gone.
Oh,
it's
okay.
It's time for legal briefs.
Oh, okay. You got to finish it with your drink, huh?
That's right.
Okay.
So, legal briefs is a part of the show where after I finish my old fashioned, that I ask Tommy different questions about the legal topics we discussed.
Or just before you finish it.
Or just before I finish. There's still a drop in there.
There's still some ice clinking.
So, the first question I have is, unicameral as opposed to bicameral. What is the difference?
Unicameral means only one body of government, like the Senate, as opposed to two bodies of government, like the Congress, the House, and the Senate.
That's right. And do you remember which state is the only one that has a unicameral?
The Cornhuskers, Nebraska.
That's right. I did not know that little bit of trivia until today. So.
I didn't either till you just said it. I hope we get that in a bar trivia.
What is the presentment clause?
The presentment clause has to do with a bill being presented to the president for his passage or vetoship.
Exactly. And it's contained in the U.S. Constitution. And it's actually been the basis as to why some of these different things have been struck down, because these different kinds of vetoes, because you strictly construe the way the presentment clause is written, then you have to strike down, especially like legislative veto and things like that.
And it doesn't provide for line item vetoes.
It does not. So what is a line item veto?
It's when you don't strike down the whole bill. You just like take your pen and cross out one sentence that you don't like and say, now we'll take that out and the rest is okay. There you go, fellas.
Pick and choose what you want.
Yeah.
That's right. And what is a legislative veto, which is a new term for me until today?
Well, that's when you have the legislature that can veto certain actions that take place, executive branch actions, such as the INS situation that you talked about.
And in 30 words or less, can you explain to me why that is inherently wrong?
Well, because they gave themselves the power when they voted that into law, and you can't vote yourself a power over another branch.
Well, that's true. But it also, it kind of changed the separation of powers a bit, too, because it gave the legislature the ability to veto the executive branch, too, which, like you said, they granted to themselves.
Yeah.
So,
and that's not good. That's what the executive branch is there for. They all got to do their part for it to all work.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the tail's wagging the dog.
The interesting thing you were talking about the vetoes and a lot of the ones that you said were viewed as good or better were that they were defending the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think if you look at it from a purist point of view, you would think, well, eventually it would have been challenged by the Supreme Court anyway and been found to be unconstitutional. So that's kind of the neat thing about our government is that there are a lot of checks and balances. So
yeah.
if one thing doesn't pass muster, then it gets through, then it'll probably get caught by something else eventually.
Yeah, and it mentioned a couple of them that did get, went to the Supreme Court and were ruled unconstitutional later on down the road.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing.
I agree.
Yep.
Nothing clever to say at the end? No words of wisdom? We're going to take that as a no. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, so we're going to get in another episode before. This will be released for Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. I forgot all about that.
May your wishbones always break in your favor.
Yeah, that and have a big turkey.
Watch your giblets.
Don't get your giblets burned.
Who burns their giblets?
A masochist.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, welcome to Tommy's Random Thoughts. Today's random thought, picking up dog poop. This past summer, I started walking in the park on a regular basis in order to help rehabilitate my newly repaired knees. Something that I immediately noticed when I began walking was people walking dogs at the park and letting them poop and then producing a plastic bag to pick the poop up and then continue their walk with the dog carrying their poop. Now, I guess I should explain that I am not a dog person. I am not a cat person. I am not really an animal person. I can't even say that I'm really a people person. So I am sure there are dog people out there that will take great offense, but I can't help it. The practice of picking up and carrying your dog's poop really grosses me out. No, I don't want you to leave it there. I would prefer you just confine them to your own yard and do whatever you want from there, because then I wouldn't have to see you. There are evidently receptacles located around the park for people to place their dog poop bags in. It's usually overflowing. I don't know who draws the short straw on the park district workers list to have to empty all that poop, but I really feel sorry for this person. I can just see them explaining the task when they go to school for their kid's career day, where the parent comes and talks about their job. I can just picture some first grader quizzing them about the different types of poop they encounter and such. That would be awful. People walk through the park proudly carrying their bag of hot, fresh dog poop. It would be one thing if they were old and stiff turds, but this is hot and fresh, right out of the oven. And when you pick it up, it just has to be gooshy. That's the best I could describe it. Gooshy. People will walk up to each other holding their steaming bag of dog droppings and just carry on a conversation like it's no big deal. I couldn't carry it or talk to someone carrying it. All I would be able to think about is that there is just a thin layer of Walmart plastic between civility and a hot, gooshy mess touching one of us in some manner. Now, I don't have that much faith in Walmart. As I stated last week, I fully intend to work for and revere our robot overlords one day because they are vastly superior to us. But dogs? Go to work for a dog and become its servant? No way. Dogs are not superior to us. They sniff each other's butts. I'll not work for a dog. And in essence, that's what you are doing every time you pick up their poop. The dog smugly watches you performing this degrading duty and says, "That's right, human. Pick up my fresh hot poop because you are my biatch." This has been Tommy's Random Thoughts.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.